So Ruben Bonilla in Corpus Christi, Texas, 2323 Morgan. I've explained to him that I'm doing a research project. This is not for publication. It's not for a release to the public. It will be placed in the archive, and that's the only way access can be had, is for a serious researcher who would sign in. I'm writing a paper, a book on Texas politics, so that's what this is. As I understand it, you're agreeing to do the interview.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's as much a disclaimer I guess we need. It is 1 o'clock, I guess. No, what, 12:10.
Right.
April 11th.
Actually, I moved that ahead, so I'm not later than I am. So it's about 12 o'clock. You're right.
All right. Well, we are recording. Basically, what I want to ask you is questions about Texas politics. Just looking at the wall, you got pictures here from Reagan, Clinton,
like
Bush,
friends, right?
Benson,
like
Kennedy, Gephardt, looks like Gore, Carter.
Superman.
I guess this is Benson. Yeah, it's Benson. And then, of course, you got a big central photo, not photo, but a poster of Amado Peña that was given to you in commemoration of your work as MAD chair in 87. So maybe we can start there with MAD. Why was MAD formed?
MAD was formed pretty much as an imperative drive to involve Mexicanos in the electoral politics, presidential campaigns. As I recall, and I was not a major player back then, in 76, I was still very much involved in LULAC, but I attended some of the organizational meetings, and folks like Tony Canales of Corpus Christi and Matt Garcia, Joe Bernal, and Rick Hernandez in particular, decided it was important to have a voice in the appointment process. And I think MAD evolved as a tool in which to facilitate the appointment or nomination of Hispanics into high political office in the Carter administration.
In Washington?
In D.C., that's correct.
That had not happened before through NCLR or MALDEF or any of those organizations?
I think it had, but it was sort of a haphazard fashion. And what happened, you had competing forces, say San Antonio submitting names, and South Texas competing names, Dr. Hector getting on the phone, and Alicia Chacon in El Paso. And I think there was a desire to make it somewhat more homogeneous and come under one umbrella and at least give the impression. In history, I guess, tells us that it may not be a correct one now, but give the impression that there was a sense of unity in the Tejano and the Tejano community in that regard, and we come up with a list, submit those names, and they'd be considered. Now, in 76, it turned out that in fact did occur. Rick Hernandez ended up as a special advisor. He was in the White House or the executive office building. Tony Canales, of course, was later named U.S. attorney, and Matt Garcia was in fact nominated for immigration chief later in the Carter administration. Not appointed, or rather not confirmed, but he was nominated. And Leonel Castillo, of course, was named INS chief prior to Matt Garcia. Leonel was named, I believe Leonel stepped down, and then Matt was going to be considered, something like that. But they were both considered for those high posts.
When did you get active in MAD?
I remained, I guess we'd call a card-carrying member throughout those years, because I had friends and had considered myself always to be a fairly traditional Democrat. But I guess my highest profile was when I was elected MAD chair in 87, more or less. And again, it was in preparation for the 88 election. And I served for a term of 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember the presidency that you had as a very activist one, unlike prior ones or even successors. What was all that about?
I think it's personality. I've always felt that if you are appointed to do a job, do it right. I have never felt that I needed a political appointment in order to be a success in life. Contrary to popular myth or opinion, I didn't have a private or personal agenda, and perhaps somewhat presumptively, I or being presumptuous about it, I thought that Mexicanos really needed a vehicle to address political concerns in a partisan way. I had done it already through LULAC, and I thought it had been fairly successful. And I saw a lot of things MAG could do to try to reform the Democratic Party. So I decided to not be singularly focused on the appointment process. If we got some folks into Washington as a result of the 88 elections, that would be great. But we had to think about those folks who still had were underutilized. We had to consider the immigration problems. We had to consider law enforcement issues, abuse against our citizens. We had to consider the gap in economic standard of living. And so we set about that mission. I also felt that MAD should form a greater alliance with the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus. I mean, if indeed we were an arm of the Democratic Party, let's get serious about it. So I did mount a crusade to carry out at least that objective.
Has MAD historically been allied with the liberal faction or the labor faction or just by itself within the Democratic Party?
I think it probably has been classified as such, as a part of the liberal factions that allegedly dominate the Democratic Party, the Black Caucus, the Brown Caucus, Labor, and gay and lesbian and women. I mean, you start chipping away at those blocks and the conventions may not have much of an attendance, you know, and I found it a little distasteful because you did have to, it's the old political gamesmanship, you have to give and take and barter. A lot of it was about who was going to be vice chair of the party, or whether the vice chair was going to be held by Hispanic that year or a black, and I thought it should always go to the best person who can do the most for Texas. Yes.
Some people that in literature that says that that at the local level, or at least in the Texas view, the MAD was created to blunt or pull back those that had been eroded and taken away by the Raza Unida party.
Say that again, Al. To blunt or erode?
To take back the people that had defected from the Democratic Party into the Raza Unida Party as a response to what the Raza Unida Party was doing in the early part of the decade of the 70s. What is your views on that?
Oh, I think if we were to talk about it literally, it would require first a chapter about the effectiveness of Raza Unida. I'm sorry. Yes? Hello? Yes. On the meeting I've got, and it's other calls, so I apologize.
No problem.
You don't have to cut it off. I'll signal to you when, if I need to.
All right. I don't care. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I don't have any
effectiveness of Raza Unida Party.
Well, the Raza Unida was, first of all, very effective. In fact, this morning, I bet I have a file right here on Ramsey Muniz. I wrote, dictated a little letter to Ramsey, not because you were going to be, but his wife, you know. Second wife, yeah, has been concerned about his health and safety and had brought me some papers. I'm not doing anything legally for him, nor am I involved in that matter, but I just wanted to tell him hello. I think that what happened to Raza Unida back in the 60s and 70s was very healthy for Texas and for the Democratic Party. In fact, when I became MAD chairman, most of the leadership consisted of former Raza Unida, let's call them converts.
Baddies, born again Democrats, is what they're called.
You know, Willie Velasquez headed up Southwest, and we had some of the county judges who had already ascended to power. I think guys in Savala County, people there were obviously old friends. Some had maybe become your foes, you know, but that's politics. But the point is that they got their baptismal in Raza Unida. And that was a very interesting experience because some thought that I was probably too conservative to, you know, lead MAD, and others thought that I was really a LULAC person and had not paid my dues to merit the trust of Mexicans in the Democratic Party. I think MAD has always been about politics more than advocacy, very frankly. I think MAD abandons the role of advocacy and yields it to the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus. And the Legislative Caucus are just, they're merely temporary guardians of the Mexicano trust and of our agenda for social and economic fairness in this state. But we tend to put our office holders on a pedestal, and we tend not to criticize them, not to challenge them, and they tell us what to do in MAD, and it should be the reverse, I think, because we're the constituents, we're the voters, we're the consumers. We should be the guardians of the community, because we don't depend upon the force of the vote. So it seems that we can be more independent. We don't have to be the pragmatic person that the Mexican-American office holder is. But I think that we sort of abdicated that role, and as a result, MAD has never reached its full potential.
You think that's part of what the problem is at the moment with the split between those Alonso MAD people and the Barrientos Tejano Democrats now?
I think so. The Tejano Democrats, I assume, are the first-generation MAD people. They're getting a little older. They don't like to give up power very easily. They also never learned to share power completely. And they're second generation. They're offspring, perhaps, I should say. Maybe not second, but it is the next generation are blocked out of MAD leadership roles because people like Roberto Alonso now took the leadership helm by whatever means, whatever reason. And apparently that, they're not willing to allow the wheel of change to move ever so slowly and allow the ordinary course of politics and voting to change the organization. Instead, they want to go set up their own organization so that their sons, their offspring, and their allies can have a leadership voice. Is it really to benefit the Mexican-American in Texas in 1995 when it began? Or is it really to have a celebration of 1976? 20 years ago it was organized. 20 years later now, the people who are now have-nots want to be haves again. And the only way to do that is to be head of an organization so that they can then impact, again, what? The selection process in 1996. If Cisneros steps down, if Peña steps down, who's going to fill the void? We've lost Ron Brown. Does that create an opportunity for another minority? So I think it's all about presidential politics. I don't think it's about a fine senator like Gonzalo Barrientos wanting to head Tejano Democrats, but I think he'd like to head an organization that pretends to represent however many million Tejanos now live in this state and say that we as one voice want Joseph Barrientos, my son, considered for U.S. attorney. And I'm not saying that's the agenda, I'm saying as an example. And I think our community is sort of blasé about it. I don't think that the Mexican community in general really cares anymore. I think that by and large, people are turned off by division, they're turned off by pettiness, and they're just really struggling to make ends meet because even though there's more jobs in America now, standard of living necessarily from the Hispanic community hadn't improved, and I think by and large people just live paycheck to paycheck. And we have both parents working now, we have a greater problem of gangs, we have a lot of problem with juvenile crime in our community, and I don't really see anybody talking about it. We have the Anglo community telling us how we should solve our own youth problems, and frankly I haven't seen an organization like MAD, or for that matter LULAC or the American GI Forum, take the leadership role, because the youth, in my mind, our population is still so very young. I don't know what our median age is now, but it has always been under 25. So while the rest of America is graying, our population is still very dark hair. and we have an opportunity to dominate, but we're not going to be able to dominate if all our kids are dropouts and are in our jail cells. And I think that's where MAD misses the boat. They should worry less about presidential politics. We've seen that everybody that's been appointed to office comes to realize he's in a fishbowl and comes under the glare and scrutiny of the media, and minorities have a greater burden to show that they're magicians and that they're angels and that they've never sinned in their life. And so they're distracted, so they never have an opportunity to fulfill their mission of providing a better life for their community.
You know, those presidential appointments and other contracts and other benefits are all tied to getting out the vote, which requires money. Has MAD really been instrumental in getting its fair share of money or brokering deals?
It never has been. Never has been. Ed Martin, Bob Slagle, of course, was the old mastermind, and Bob's from the good old boy, yellow dog, Democratic tradition of East Texas, and to this day, I think he really thought that a good Mexican was a good farm worker, you know, but he really never got into the realization that 21st century was just a few years away and that we're in a new technology and we have a wide divergence of Mexicanos, and he has to not only address the needs of the lower middle class but also the growing upper middle class, and those people are becoming increasingly Republican. And so consequently, money was never allocated in measured amounts to emphasize first voter registration. And then I think you have to have a voter education campaign to stimulate that vote. And lastly, the GOTV. A lot of times they just pump money to a community and say, get out the vote. Well, you can't just go on radio and TV and say, come out and vote if people don't have a reason or if they haven't been educated as to the candidates, or worse, they haven't been registered to vote.
What opportunities do you see now that most of the conservative Democrats have become Republicans and the party basically is in the hands of potentially those few liberals that remain, those other interested factions, and the blacks and browns?
I don't know. I guess that's the $64 question, to use a cliche. Willie Velasquez, if he were here, would put a positive spin on it. And he'd say that our day in the sun is near, that we, in a sense, have already ushered in a new wave of opportunity. We've got Dan Morales. He'll start rattling off names better than anybody ever could. Dan Morales, a state attorney general, Raul Gonzalez, Texas Supreme Court Justice. Now Victor Morales, a Cinderella story, as a nominee of the Democratic Party, having for the United States Senate, the one race below United States President, United States Senator. Isn't that what we've always strived for? In 1996, we have reached the pinnacle of success. Or have we done it at the expense of alienating and driving away conservative Anglos, with whom we have to forge an alliance and partnership so that we can understand the economic needs of our community? I suspect that in November there's going to be a significant backlash, and I think we're going to see more conservative voters cross over Democratic rather to the Republican Party, and we're going to see increasingly the Democratic Party be just a party of minorities. That may be great for our leadership ego, but I'm not sure that we'll be able to control the legislature. Because we start losing the conservative Democrats in West Texas, in the Panhandle, and in East Texas, then we may be the dominant force in the Democratic Party and, in fact, control all the leadership in the Democratic Party. Not in MAD, but in the leadership party. But we'll lose legislative seats, we'll lose control of the Texas legislature, we'll lose control of the Texas Senate, which are now held by Democrats. And if the Republicans take over, it's going to be one bad day in the state of Texas, because we're going to see a lot of the programs that benefit our folks, like Medicaid, other areas of public health, all go down the drain. And I think tort reform will be as well. Speaking as a lawyer, from a selfish standpoint, I think tort reform will go to such a high level that people who are injured in the course of employment, or people who are injured as a result of someone's negligence or the manufacture of defective product, will have no redress in the courts as we know it existed prior to today. I think that's a real danger looming in Texas today. So MAD has been, in my opinion, a little bit short-sighted because we have developed this caucus system that is self-serving, and we should have been serving the state of Texas. We should have been serving our fellow Texans, because all Texans, I think, have the same concerns that Mexicanos have. We may have a special set of circumstances, but I think all Texans want, you know, industry in this state. All Texans want tourism in this state, and all Texans want a better standard of living, better jobs, better universities. But how are we going to pay for it? I'm not sure that MAD has fulfilled the role it needed here in the last 10 years. Without criticizing any of the MAD chairs, because they're all good, decent people, and I know them, and they're all good friends, but Nora Linati served as chair, and she was appointed head of the Lottery Commission. Mark Gompel served as chair, was then appointed to the Mark White gubernatorial staff, and later, of course, set up Gompel Communications, I assume. Matt Garcia was chair, and as I mentioned, later served in the legislature, but also was appointed to INS chief, but not confirmed. And we can go on down the line. I think Roberto Alonso may be a throwback to the guy who would like to do something for La Raza, something for the people, and use his legislative position as a conduit to do things more successfully. I don't know that he ever had an opportunity. Anytime you have a schism in your organization, whether it's in the Catholic Church in the days past or in a political organization like MAD, I think it's very unhealthy.
Well, educate me now, switching subjects to politics in the Gulf Coast area. Two areas, and I'll just let you talk. There's been a historic divide between LULAC GF Forum, between Bonillas, Garcias, and that continues today, apparently because the groups here don't seem to gel to take over. And in the second part is, in this general area, we seem to have now a new group, a large number of elected officials, and yet problems continue to persist.
Well, what I think that that's one of the fascinating studies. We, people like you and I, who grew up probably in poverty, my parents were educated not very well. My dad, third grade education, my mother, about a second grade. They were both from Mexico. I'm a first generation American.
When were they born? This biography is important.
My dad was born in 1905 and passed away in 1968 when I was a senior at the University of Texas. And my mother, born in 1905, passed away in 1991.
They were born where in Mexico?
My dad in La Capital, Mexico City, my mother in Monterrey. My dad came over shortly after the Mexican Revolution.
Exile?
No, he came over just to find work, and he worked in pipelines and went up to the Midwest and worked in Louisiana and finally settled in Calvert, Texas, which is central Texas and not very heavy Mexicano population, and consequently our draw, because, you know, they didn't know what Mexicans were there too well, although they knew what wetbacks were. And I remember as a youngster being subjected to that indignity, even though, you know, I didn't understand it. But my dad was very courageous, and eventually, although he worked in a gas station just pumping gas, he eventually became a manager and saved enough money, he bought himself a little service station and sent all his children to college with whatever money he made from that gas station, even though...
This is in Calvert, or by the time you moved to Corpus?
No, in Calvert. I didn't move to Corpus until 1960, although my brother William had moved to Corpus in about 52. But, you know, they like all good parents, they stressed an education, then let school. Willie, my oldest brother, finished high school at the age of 16, finished law school at 21, so he was like a child prodigy. All of that led to a sense of activism because we saw what our parents had gone through, and we...
Can you name all the brothers and sisters?
William, Albert, my oldest, Albert, William, Tony, Ben, myself, Reuben, Rachel, Esther, and Mary Helen. Mary Helen, now being Mary Helen Bonilla Berlanga. But our sense of community service has always been to rise above the professional level. In fact, this morning I was at an elementary school talking to kids and about networking. It's a 99.9% Mexicano school, and we're losing a lot of these kids, and I just wanted to see what's going on. I don't have a child or anything, but it's about a mile and a half from here, and I've been helping them financially a little bit, and I wanted to go see what was happening. A lot of things like that are important to they are a generation, but it's not so important to the new generation of McDonald leaders. I was going back and saying that those of us then raised in that setting felt that a Mexicano had to have certain characteristics to be effective office holder. We were hungry for political power. We wanted and yearned to have our people elected to office, but frustrated at every turn by all sorts of mechanisms, from the, as you know, poll tax to segregated voting sites to
Texas Rangers,
Texas Rangers, railroads, expressways, changing precincts, clustering precincts, doing anything to confuse the people, to discourage the vote. Well, when we finally started electing people, it was pretty exciting. When we finally filed lawsuits for single-member district, it became sensational. So we thought that all these people were going to come back and serve the community and change our lifestyle. And I guess to some extent we have, or haven't. Have they or have we? In other words, do we see more people successful because of the opportunities given us by Mexicano leadership, people in elective power? Or are we more successful because we've had a wave of Mexicano parents who were educated and decided to send their kids to college, and those kids came back and made a difference in their community? I don't know which is the answer. Probably a combination of both. But what we have seen here, alarmingly, in the 90s, is Mexicanos forgetting their roots, and Mexicanos being no different than the Anglos we tried to oust because they were not sensitive to our community. Without, again, trying to be overly self-righteous or full of venom, our county judge here, Richard Barchard, runs on Spanish radio, Ricardo Martinez Barchard. He runs in the Anglos, Richard Barchard. Well, most people know he's Hispanic of German, you know, extraction. I think one of his parents is German, the other Mexican. But he's purebred Mexicano, Rocksdown product, educated at Texas A&I, or now Texas A&M Kingsville.
Wasn't he a buddy of Ramsey's?
Probably not. He would have been, he's younger. He's younger than me, probably 46 or so. But Richard was elected to county. He served under Salomon Ortiz. He's a protege of Ortiz. Served as deputy sheriff and later served as drainage commissioner in Rocksdown. Eventually elected county commissioner, did a good job there, and elected county judge, first Mexicano county judge. First thing out of the chute, there's an appointment to the Port Authority. I mean, the port, most powerful mechanism to attract tonnage, raw tonnage, manufacturing, shipping, those are big bucks, million-dollar enterprises. Nobody knows about that. The Mexicano community never well-versed about what happens on at the port. It's been a toy of the so-called financial establishment for generations in this community. Well, we have an opportunity to appoint a Mexicano, and he appoints a guy named Mark Hewling, who lives in Austin but commutes a lot, and he determined that because he's still registered here to vote, that he could appoint him. Well, it's a political payoff. We had four Mexicanos in the county commission court. Borchard, Oscar Ortiz, David Berlanga, who has since passed away, and Frank Schwing. Four Mexicanos and Joe McComo, Republican. Four Mexicano votes. The opportunity to control, dominate, and shape not only the economy of the Coastal Bend, but also rework all of the political appointments. And they appointed an Anglo to a position that they easily should have given to a Mexicano. And then a position came along in the RTA, I believe, and they appointed another Anglo. Well, oh, and they had a tax collection account, the judge is in the hip pocket of the Lime Barger firm in Austin. They have, you know, tax collection accounts all over the state of Texas. They do a good job, but a consortium of lawyers here got together, including Tony Canales and myself, and thought since, you know, we want to diversify. We don't need to be known just as personal injury lawyers. We want to diversify our business opportunities. We submitted a proposal along with some Anglo lawyers all together. We weren't going to make a lot of money because so many of us, but we wanted to bring the business back to Corpus Christi law firms so we could stimulate the economy and create jobs for clerks and staff and the like, and maybe use this as a stepping point to move across Texas and get other contracts like Lime Barger's done. And we were voted down by our own Mexicanos, and the contract was awarded to Lime Barger. I don't know the circumstances. Some people say graft, some people say corruption, some people believe bribes. But I just think it's political patronage that you owe someone. You not only owe them, they own you. And so we have Mexicanos in political power now who are owned by the people who we opposed all these years. So it's no different. So does it have to be different? I think that's a part of the maturity. That is, that if we elect a Mexicano, let's not expect him to act like a Mexicano. He's just an American. And he's going to be susceptible to the same pressures, to the same threat of corruption and graft, and to the same innuendos and pragmatic overtures that are made to every office holder since America was established as a republic. And because we're brown, we're no different. I mean, we've seen that almost in every county in the state of Texas. And it's a little sad because we had a idealism in the 60s, you know, born out of Kennedy, born out of Martin Luther King, Raso Nida. We had an idealism that we could shape things and it was going to be our destiny to manage our political development in a more intelligent manner to where we'd benefit our kids, our generation. And I guess to some extent we have, because we have elected people in all areas and they have made a difference. But on the other hand, you look at Raul Gonzalez. He's a great judge, no question about it. And it would be wrong for me to say that because he is a rubber stamp for the defense industry and for the insurance companies, that he's not a good man. That's a philosophical difference. It doesn't go to the statement of his qualifications or his pedigree or his intelligence. But I was shocked, as probably most Mexicans were, that he would join the majority in a decision on higher education that said that there was no discrimination against Hispanics in South Texas. I mean, that takes a lot of either courage or takes a lot of stupidity. So I don't know which category he falls in, but that's an amazing statement that he would join in that majority. He could have dissented and spelled out in a very brilliant way and become a hero to our community, the generations of neglect, and not benign neglect, but just terrible intentional neglect of our region. You have Dan Morales, who I've supported, a good man, well-educated, Ivy League educated, and they've just appointed some law firms to take on the tobacco industry. It wouldn't have hurt to have a few minority firms be at least of counsel, you know? Give them a few dollars. I mean, hell, he didn't get elected by Quinn, O'Quinn. He didn't get elected by Humphrey. He got elected because Mexican-Americans wanted a Hispanic to be Attorney General. He got elected by this wave of voters, and if he denies that, then he's mistaken. I won't say he's a liar, but he's mistaken. It'd be like Victor Morales, who got elected, obviously, or nominated, because Mexicano turned out in greater numbers, because we had more contested races locally, so our community turned out in greater numbers than the Anglos. They didn't care. They didn't have any reason to vote for a liberal like John Bryan. They let the other liberal, Mexican liberal, lead up the white liberal. Let's let them fight it out. That's what happened to John Bryan. Be like Victor Morales now saying, thanks for the vote, I'm going to vote to eliminate Medicare. And you know, that's not why Mexicanos go to vote. That's why I say we have to do a tremendous amount of education, but who's going to do it? Who has the resources? I see that with the passing of time, the degeneration of American GI Forum, American GI Forum without the voice of Dr. Hector Garcia is but a hollow organization. LULAC has taken some hard hits, and while Belen Robles, I've been impressed that she's been able to take on some issues, but the network of advocacy is not what it was some years ago. MAD is certainly maybe electioneering, but they're not doing anything else. So that leaves it to National Council La Raza, and they don't have a network of grassroots organizations. They have only funded organizations. And I guess that leaves MALDEF, which is a litigation arm and not an advocacy arm. So I see a somewhat, the Hispanic community right now, I think is sort of rudderless. There's, you know, you have to consider what we've lost. Everyone talks about what we've gained, but we gained it through the likes of people like Dr. Hector in the party, and, you know, he's very, very ill and out of the picture now. We've lost Willie Velasquez, and Willie's really the most formidable person probably in terms of continuing that grassroots evolution that was initiated by Raza Unida. And then, of course, if people talk about farm work, we lost Cesar Chavez. So we've lost a lot of people who were not elected officials, who I think provided the inspiration for others to see public service as a way of serving their Mexicano community. These people sort of reminded those Hispanic officials that they needed to be accountable to the Hispanic community first. And it doesn't seem that that's an essential trait any longer of our elected officials.
How do Mexicano candidates around here do politics? What do they do to get elected?
I've seen an assortment of things. In Corpus Christi, you've got a new group called the Alliance, and it's the old Chamber of Commerce, but it's a merger of the Chamber of Commerce and the Economic Development Corporation and the Visitors and Tourist Bureau. But it's got all your hitmen. It's all, got all your main financial players. And they can come together and support a Mexicano financially, and that Mexicano can probably have a pretty good chance of winning. We had a district judge candidate here in this election, Annette Hassett, who came out of nowhere. But she built a good organization. She got support of some plaintiff lawyers, and she's, you know, attractive lady, and ran a smart grassroots campaign, and she beat two challengers rather handily. Larry Olivares, on the other hand, used a different approach. He has always been very strong in the business community, working in the anti-drug campaign, working with youth, working with the Special Olympics. So his campaign chairmen were Anglos. But his base, obviously, because of the surname Olivares, was Hispanic. And anyone who runs now in the Democratic primary has a built-in 35-40% of vote if he's the only Hispanic in the race. And it only takes, I say, 35-40% of the usual Mexicano turnout, those people who are always going to vote. Then it's his job to, I guess, stimulate interest in the race so that there's a higher turnout and higher are going to be his numbers. Of course, he did just that. He won, although he was a neophyte. He'd never run for political office. And he did the reverse. Hassett started with a Hispanic base and a Hispanic steering committee. Olivares, Hispanic-based Anglo steering committee. So my point is that if you got the money, it doesn't really matter who your campaign chairs are. If you got the looks and you're not burned out, you have a pretty good chance in this county.
In this county, is this a TV market?
I feel it is. It's still radio is still used effectively, Spanish radio. There's AM and FM stations, so good things come out of that.
Do people pay to get the vote out and get early votes cast and the elderly signed up and voted?
Quite a bit.
Or is it done by volunteers?
No such thing as volunteers. I mean, they may call themselves volunteers, but I think they're...
That's going out the window?
You mean groups like, say, LULAC or...
Well, at one time, most all of the early Mexicano candidates relied on volunteers, family, who actually went out and did it for free.
Well, I guess Frank Schwing had a lot of that. He had an extended family. Arnold Gonzalez, former state legislator, is a cousin. And Arnold's son, who's now an attorney. All those folks did go out and work hard. And there's no question in my mind they had an early voting campaign. No question in my mind that... Nanette Hassett, she goes by Hassett, had a strong early voting campaign. I'm surprised, and that's done pretty much undercover because you don't want to alert the opposition you're doing it, right? But as a community service, I think that organizations should really harp upon that and say that, you know, election day is no longer whatever it was here, April. Well, March, the election day is in January, and I'm always a little mixed about why we cannot get our votes, get all our votes out early. I mean, I guess I know the reason we gotta have...
Did this lady, Helen Tagle, get confirmed?
Hilda Tagle.
Hilda
Tagle. There's rumblings that the Republicans are going to hold her up until after the election. I don't know if that's true or not.
Is that the first Mexican-American woman that you know of a name for a judicial post at the federal level?
As far as I know.
How did that happen?
Right place, right time. That lady just is, you know, has good luck. A lot of this is just good luck. That's not through the help of Matt or anything. She was working right down the street here with Amador Garcia. She was divorced, had a hard life, really didn't have much of a private practice, and bounced around a little bit from Robstown, and a position became available in county court of law. I believe it was when Joaquin Villarreal was appointed district judge. And through Dr. Hector's influence with the county judge, because Hilda's mother was very, very involved in the American GI Forum, but Dr. Hector, who'd been a friend of Judge Barnes for years and years and years, called upon a chip. So Hilda was appointed county court of law judge. She did well, and then made a run against an incumbent, Margarito Garza, who had already been censured by the Judicial Standards Commission up in Austin, and she beat Marty Garza. And no sooner has she taken office than a vacancy came up, or it's a new post created, I don't know which, and she was touted, recommended and touted. I think her Jorge Rangel was actually going to be considered a second time, and he took his name out of the running. He has kids in school still, in middle school. He has a daughter and he has a son in high school, so I don't think he wanted to make the move to Brownsville or be commuting all the time. Hilda was
that. Irma Rangel was the first Mexican-American woman elected legislator. She now heads the Higher Education Committee, sits over Kingsville and Corpus, and while it's only her first term as chair, there doesn't seem to be any change or any plans to make any changes at these universities. Very few Hispanic faculty students are not getting education that they deserve.
Hard to take on the King Ranch, isn't it? You know, you just don't. She's gotten opponents the last two times, and she's beaten them off. But with the support of, I assume, the O-line traditional forces, it's easy for us probably to say, as I told my buddy Hugo Berlanga, what the hell are you doing cutting a spot for the tort reform advocates, Hugo? You know, we've been buddies. You started in LULAC, you were a teacher at Juvenile Center here. You have risen through the ranks. You've got a remarkable tenure in the state legislature. Speaker pro tem, first Mexicano. You're now chairman of public health. Public health is one of the most important issues in America today. Why would you go off and do that crap? You know, I was very upset, as were many people. That's why I ended up with an opponent. He beat him off handily, but I supported Hugo because we're like brothers. But, you know, people make mistakes, and they just exercise poor judgment in my mind. And sometimes they just don't take their job seriously. They don't realize all the power that comes with a position. And frankly, I don't think they know how to handle it. I'll give you, I think that, not to patronize you or myself, but, you know, when you were head of Rasanida, You had a Herculean effort, had a national impact, operating out of a town that had no media market. Things like that happen for a reason. It's not just timing. It happens because a cord is touched or the jugular vein ruptures. Something happens to excite people. And we've seen that happen with Cisneros. Cisneros, I mean, everybody had been mayor of San Antonio, but when Cisneros did it, he started talking about the great Spanish tradition and evoking memories of the heroes of the Alamo and doing it with such ease and eloquence that it brought together forces that had historically been opposed to one another. I guess Mickey Leland did it in the black community, and there are people like that who make a difference through their mere presence and through their ability to articulate issues. But we don't have people who can articulate issues very well. You tell me the last time Salomon Ortiz stood up and mesmerized the crowd on anything. And I'm not bitter with Salomon because he defeated my sister. I didn't take much of a role in that race, Mayor Helen Berlanga, because I didn't want to be the target, you know. But soon after the election, he voted to repeal the ban on assault weapons. Now, we've got all this growing crime. We've got lawlessness in Texas. We got handgun permit, and then he votes to bring in, to allow us to bring in more assault weapons. I don't understand those type of votes by people who realize it's our people going to be killed. It's our community going to be killed, you know. So I have become, as you can tell, somewhat of a resident cynic, and I haven't given up because I decided I'm gonna work with young people because they have the same idealism that I think we had and that I still maintain hope for the future. I just don't think all our people are so insensitive to the needs of our community. I don't know what it will take short of an earthquake, but maybe we can educate our youngsters. They don't have to be Mexicano in the sense of doing el grito, you know, or celebrating Cinco de Mayo. They just, I think, have to have a social conscience. And we have lost some of our values. We've lost the sight of a lot of family unity. I mean, we've always prided ourselves on saying, you know, the old traditional line, the Republican. Anytime you talk to Republican, Hispanic, well, I'm Republican, so we in the Hispanic community have always upheld the values of family, love, God, apple pie, and religion. We believe in that more than any American or equal to any American. But do we? I mean, our families are torn apart. We have more latchkey program participants than anybody else, probably. We have more parents working at night, so the kids are left alone at night. We don't enforce curfew rules anymore. We let the kids watch whatever they want to on TV. We're a disoriented society right now, and that's because nobody is talking it up. I suspect the clergy could come in and fill the void, but I don't see the Catholic Church doing it either. The Catholic Church will ask you for money, but you don't know necessarily where the money goes. So I'd like someone to tell me what is exactly the answer. I don't think it's politics. I don't think that the political sages of today, I'm talking about public office holders, are going to make a significant difference. There almost has to be like a revolution among the folks. But I'm not sure the folks are up to it because of all the economic problems and social problems we face.
Are you aware of the goings-on in Memphis and Robstown?
Not about the church?
Well, no, in Memphis, change seems to have been lost once the opportunity came in 63. That was the other Crystal City, if you will.
Right.
And Mexicanos under Paso were able to take over, and then there was that killing of that doctor.
Right.
Now that the machine there seems to be all Anglo-dominated. There's not even Mexicano teachers to speak of in the high school, and it is just simply a throwback, and it's just a stone throw away from here. Doesn't seem like it fits. Robstown, just the opposite. Raza Unida came in, took over, opened up the avenues. Democrats, Mexican-Americans, then took over from Raza Unida. It seems to be in terrible problems. I just thought maybe you might shed some other light because I just know what I just said.
Yeah.
I don't know anything else.
Yeah, I'm not too well versed. I have a lot of clientele in Memphis. I know that there have been problems with financial accountability in Memphis. We have not. Memphis has never been, aside from the lake, which is, you know, supposed to be part one of our reservoirs, it's more of a recreational area than anything. It's just never been brought into the regional economic planning. Robstown seems to have been a training ground for our elected officials countywide. Richard Barchard.
Well, we go back to Raza Unida, I think, on that one. Huh?
That's right. Joaquin Villarreal, Salomon Ortiz. But their impact has been greater once they leave Robstown. Robstown lost Hager Slacks, and no one seemed to really think it was important. Robstown has a bypass now, so you don't have to even go through the city. Well, you get a stretch of it, but the biggest thing Robstown has is baseball team in, so they usually can get to the state championship through the 4A category. Sadly, we just haven't seen the industrial component fed into Robstown. It's not in the ratio. When this alliance meets, I believe that they should talk about regional planning, but very little of that is done. Although, I guess they're part of this philosophy of the trickle-down theory that, you know, you create job opportunities through industry locating Corpus Christi, it'll filter down and impact the surrounding 60-90 mile radius.
Is there any kind of counterpart to this alliance? I mean, you
Hispanic
alluded
Chamber
to this.
Of Commerce, Hispanic Chamber of Commerce has become somewhat more viable, and but they don't meet regularly. But, you know, it's, I would say that it probably it has grown in stature, and they've got some good folks in leadership position. But, you know, it's strictly business-oriented, and it's not an advocacy group per se, but they do have some missions into Mexico and the like.
Not many years ago, you couldn't talk about politics in Corpus without talking about the Bonilla family or the Garcias or Bonillas and Garcias. Is that still true today?
No, I don't think that I think that we are, what shall you say, not in the twilight, but we're in the dusk. The sun is set on that era because Dr. Hector and us, and contrary to myth, aside from that 1966 race where Tony, my brother, was opposed by Dr. Hector and eventually defeated, I don't believe that there has been a period of animosity. Certainly when I got out of college in 1971, Dr. Hector was always there to help, support, encourage me. When I was LULAC president, he participated with me in numerous press conferences. And since I was national president, I mean, I fed him information because I would get it first. I mean, I was a so-called president, and I had a pipeline to all major decision-making outlets in the country. So there were many times I called him, and we even traveled together a few times. So there'd always been a kinship and a bond. But I think that when you're vibrant and in your, both in your formative years and your creative years, you feed off of one another, you bounce ideas off one another, your colleagues, your proteges, and with failing health, that's no longer possible. And so you don't have people who are interested in, say, reading a book for a new idea, reading a magazine, and saying, we can do that in Corpus Christi. We don't see that occurring too much. My brother William must be 65 now, and he's grandfatherly. He's, you know, more interested in his grandchildren and thinking, talking retirement, although he still looks very good. Tony is 60 now, and bought a little bit of land out in George West and enjoys going out there and spending the weekends. And I've got four kids, ranging from 9 to 16. So you know what I'm doing.
How old are you now?
I'm 50. I'm president of the Ray High School Booster Club. So from, you know, an advocate that marched with Ruben Sandoval in West Texas against police brutality to the days of LULAC president and MAD chairman, I've gone in reverse. Usually you start off working in your schools and then filter out into elected position or volunteer work and become heads of organization. But I'm probably more at ease and comfort with myself than I have been in a very long time because I'm doing things that directly impacts the school I'm involved in, and then I can see it impacting not just my children, but other kids. I think that, you know, we tend to forget the people. We've always traditionally forgotten the people. I was at T.G. Allen, and I wrote them a letter, and I sent them a little check, and unsolicited, they wrote me all these letters on computers. These are third, fourth graders using computers, and they're really heartwarming letters. So you bring your donation brings happiness to our hearts. They will buy new books for all students to read and educate themselves. There's one in here that says, "You're a neat person. I wish that I were your daughter, so that I could enjoy all the good things that you have done." You know, and I said, "Shoot, man, that's pretty heavy." You know, and I wish I was going to frame that one, even one like this, a little truth. Thank you for giving the library money for books and for discs. We like to read. Obviously, a little first grader, you know, they have a lot of bilingual kids there, meaning that they're from recently from Mexico. But, you know, it's I made a difference there, and I don't think you could count on any of our office holders to go into these schools other than maybe read for 30 minutes, get a photo op, 30 seconds of news, and head out, right? And maybe that's what's wrong. This might be the call. Yes. Hey, how you doing? You see, now what I said, I think I'll be back. I thought I had to step out a minute there. It's pretty interesting, though, right? No, she never told me that. Yeah. Oh, that's too bad. You still have time to meet, or? Okay. Weren't you going to meet with Mel today, too? Okay. Yeah, I'll just wait here, and I'm doing a couple of things right now anyway. I needed to catch up. So call me, and either way, I'll understand. Yeah. Right. Okay. All right. Well, that's the deal. I'll be here. Okay, bye.
Black-brown relations, can we get along?
Can who?
Black and brown relations, can we get along?
I think we get along locally. I think when you get to the patronage, there's a problem. Because there's never enough to go around, right? You divide a big pie, and the big boy takes 9 pieces and gives you 1 piece and say, y'all split it up. There's not too much split up, so you want that 1 piece, but you're asked to share it with the black, and so there's hurt feelings. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but in a microcosm, I think that's sort of the way it's been. Now, the good thing about controlling the Democratic Party, like I said, is that you can set your own terms. You can cut the pie the way you want to.
Well, you know, in Houston, now Mexicanos are more than blacks. That's not the case in the past. In Dallas, now Mexicanos are more than blacks, and blacks are not happy. They see every gain by Mexicanos that's coming from at their expense.
Yeah. Well, in Corpus Christi, the blacks have traditionally allied with the Anglo business establishment for the same reason. Mexicanos were a threat, but we only have 2 on city council of 9, 2 Mexicanos here. John Longoria and Betty Jean Longoria, not related. 2 out of 9, and we have a modified at-large system. We don't have a pure single-member district. So the municipality is the last, and we have no blacks on the council, but that's the last bastion, you know. That's the last holdout, because countywide, Mexicanos can win. At-large, citywide, a Mexicano still cannot win in Corpus Christi, because even though we may be close to having the numerical strength, we don't have the voter registration strength, and then the turnout. So, you know, we just can't manage a victory. In fact, a Mexicano has never won at large in this new modified system. It's not that old, but I guess it's probably about 10 years old, maybe a little older. But on the other hand, within the Democratic Party, I think there's an alliance of blacks and browns. Work pretty well, mainly because of organized labor, but labor's not the power it was 10 years ago. Blacks are about 7% here.
In many of the urban areas, a large number of persons that are Mexicanos are residents, not citizens. Should we allow residents to vote without requiring citizenship?
I don't think so. I think we should give them the free public education offering, which, you know, the House voted to abolish that, I think. In LULAC, I passed constitutional amendment. I don't know if they've abolished it since then, they probably have, but I passed constitutional amendment that residents could become members of LULAC, which was a break from the citizenship requirement. But the reason I don't support, it may not be a good reason on the voting, is that I think that, and I assume you mean permanent, I guess it doesn't matter whether it's permanent resident or temporary resident, but I just want everyone to make an investment, you know, a commitment to American citizenship, because I think it's so precious and shouldn't be taken lightly. And I don't want to see any further backlashes. If that somehow were to pass legislatively, I could just see an increase in discriminatory treatment towards our people just because of the attitudes. The teacher I was at told me that the Border Patrol came over to give a demonstration on their dogs and stuff, and that they invited parents, not a single parent showed up. Yeah. So even in Corpus Christi, which is not on the border. See? So, I don't know. I don't know if the people would come forward, even if they were off, because of the fear of government blackmail or traps, that sort of thing.
U.S.-Mexico relations, should Chicanos be involved in trying to interject themselves in that battle?
More so than ever. I don't know all the ramifications of NAFTA, you know, if it'll do all that it's destined to do or predicted to do, but... Oh, absolutely. At one time, you know, Hispanic organizations had established a Comisión Mixta, which integrated itself in meetings with high-level Mexican officials, and it was criticized, of course, by, you know, Secretary of State and American government as interference with American foreign policy. But I think it's very healthy to do that and to go beyond that and have cultural exchanges, have student exchanges, university exchanges. Basically have a free and open border so that there can be a development of this confidence between the two people. Maybe we could in that manner eliminate some of the terrible events as in California a few days ago. I think that the chambers of commerce, you know, around the southwestern United States finally discovered that Mexico was a pretty damn good trading partner. And they may have gone in there and undercut the natural Mexican-American allegiance that should have existed all these years.
In 92, we had a tremendous opportunity to celebrate 500 years of Hispanic heritage, and Corpus Christi is among other places. Was in the middle of that big fight, whether we're more Indio than Mexican or Spanish, for sure. And then, as a consequence, nobody celebrated our birthday. We have the three carabelas here in Corpus. You've used the word Hispanic repeatedly. You also use the word Tejano. Can you make some comment about the identity politics?
I think most people... I'll just say Mexicano. You know, my buddy Willie always just said Mexican. He said just,
Velasquez.
Yeah, Willie Velasquez. He just always said Mexican. I remember as if it were yesterday. You know, Mexicans are going to win here. Mexican vote is here. And in that county where the Mexicans are not quite strong enough, and nobody was offended by it. You know, he could do it. Ann Richards or someone like that would not be able to do it. Term Chicano is still used in certain areas. I don't really think that there is an identity crisis per se. I remember we used to get real hung up on what we were, and it caused friction among the different groups in the 70s, and LULAC, of course, was always criticized because I think there was a group in LULAC that said we should not be hyphenated Americans, you know, we should just be Americans. But I used to have a little joke in my, when I began my speech, to say that they tell us that, and then when we finished giving a speech, they say, who in the hell was that Mexican anyway, you know? And, so I said, even though we speak like an American, act like American, and talk patriotism, when we turn our back, they'll wonder where that Mexican learned to speak like that, you know? So that's why we should be proud of what we are and continue to be Mexican American. I don't really think it matters. Hispanic probably fits a blank space on a application form a little better, you know? I think that... in parts of Texas. If you have a Mexicano, Chicano, Latino, Tejano, or Mexican surname, it doesn't matter. You still got going to have two strikes against you. So the origination of the name doesn't trouble me too much. I like people to feel comfortable being what they are.
Vilma Luna is now a representative here. Irma Rangel was the first. Two more got elected just last month or so. Dora Olivo in Sugarland, Norma Chavez in El Paso. I think now the number is either 9 or 10 Mexican-American women in the legislature. Do women do politics different, these Chicanas?
No question they do. No question they do.
How so?
Well, I haven't figured that out. But I think there where we were as so-called macho men in the 70s, where we were hungry, we had a thirst for power, and we used the emotion of language, the emotion of body politics to get more people out to vote than ever been done. We used the media effectively, and we used our network effectively. And we had a few women, like Alicia Chacon and others, but you know, by and large, it was an organization of men. It's always been that way. And I think here recently, we've seen that it is the women's era, and women are sticking together more than ever before. We saw a Justice of the Peace race here. Lisa Gonzalez, she's a Yale graduate, married to Joseph Barrientos, who is Gonzalo Barrientos' son. First time office run, and she had a strong network of, I won't say fanatic women, they're just strong, mobilized women. Who supported her. And of course, her opponent had been charged with abuse of his wife on more than one occasion. So you put those two factors together, and it's no contest. She won over a guy named Black Longoria, who had a tremendous name ID, and he'd been a police officer, he'd been a boxer. I mean, he's just very well known. And that was a surprise. She defeated him in a runoff. Hilda Tagle is another example, when she ran against Garza. So the Hispanic woman is able to draw also from the liberal, Anglo, and also from the conservative female. I think across political, ethnic, social lines, so women are for women, and they'll all come and join that bandwagon. Nanette Hassett is the other one. As I mentioned to you, she was also a political novice, has been practicing law probably less than 6 years, a graduate, I think, of South Texas School of Law. So it's not by the result, unlike Lisa Gonzalez, who came from the best schools in America, and like I said, did it the hard way, you know, night school and all, but the results were the same. So it has less to do with, say, social pedigree or education than it does the network. And I think that they do call and appeal upon that instinct for leadership, and we're finding that these women are now the role models of our community, and I think it's a healthy sign. Really good.
You think if Henry were to come back, Cisneros, he would have, by default, the leadership mantle on him?
Probably so. I'm not sure he would want it. I'm not sure he's comfortable with it. His indecisiveness has probably cost him the U.S. Senate. You know, I think that because Henry is Henry, that he's under that same microscope fishbowl that we all live in, makes it tough for him to be a candidate without him having a sentence in the article or profile about some scandal. And it's unfair to Henry because I doubt that there's anyone who has no flaws in America today. You know, they dig deep enough, they'll find something on everybody. And our country was probably built on graft. And people like Lyndon Johnson didn't make millions by accident, you know, or by intellect, but by crafty deals and kickbacks and payola, you know. But we live in a different time now, so maybe we rose to power at the wrong time in American political history.
Not trying to project guilt by association, but do you think that was the rise of Hector Garcia, is that relationship with Lyndon? Over that Felix Longoria incident?
Well, there's no question that whenever there's a profile, that it all goes back to that particular incident. And sometimes it just takes a little spark, and it gives rise to a legend. And they were buddies. Johnson, I guess, used to serve a legislative assistant to Clayburgh or something like that from the Yamdick area. So they had that kinship. It's no different than a lot of McDonald's in Texas are close to Gary Morrow. You know, Gary Morrow ever became U.S. Senator or occupied a position of trust in the White House under Clinton. Some Mexicano in Texas would be able to call Gary Morrow and open up a door that would achieve something that nobody else can achieve. So I think Dr. Garcia was blessed to have those contacts. But he didn't stop there. Once he found that success, then he broadened his contact into the sheer power of personality. He got a lot done. And that's where we are a bit laid back. We're a bit complacent. We are a bit timid about offending folks, so we don't use these days that same power of personality. Maybe because we are under such public scrutiny and we don't control the ink in the barrel, and the newspapers can be very, very vicious.
Why don't our people of the national stage reach out to make those linkages? We don't have the access to the White House like African Americans. We don't sit on many of those foundation boards or have access to that largesse, those monies. Why are we behind? Why are we lagging? Even this Friday is the first civil rights struggle of Chicanos movie on PBS. That's 20 years too late. Why are we behind the curve?
I'm not sure I can answer that. It's access to national boards, corporations even to this date don't fully appreciate the strength of the Mexicano consumer, the value of the dollar. Some make grudging acceptance and are advertising now heavily on our Spanish TV stations in particular. But that doesn't translate into appointments to their major boards. I suspect we have a few folks.
Lots of women. Not lots, but more women than men.
Yeah, and a lot of it associated with wealth. If the Hispanic has gained independent wealth, then they're more likely to be considered for an appointment. And if that's a prerequisite, well, you pretty much discount, 99% of your Hispanic population. On the other hand, people like Vernon Jordan, who probably has served on many, many, many boards as an African-American, did make some money as a lawyer, but he made most of his money, after coming off the Urban League board or presidency, because after that he joined a prestigious law firm and then got appointed to 6-7 boards. So after he became high profile, he too used his position to escalate and to accelerate his economic prominence in this country. We don't have any sort of a training ground for Mexicanos. It's never been a part of our, say, agenda for social progress to say, in addition to having a good home and a good job, we shall also work to get you, young man, appointed to a national board of a Fortune 500 company. It's just never. If you attend any of the national organizational meetings, or if you talk about MAD, it's just never an issue discussed. There are Texas-owned and Texas-controlled corporations that could easily fit in any number of Mexicanos, but I don't see it occurring.
We're at the almost end of the century. What's your assessment? We're going to see a Mexicano governor, a Mexicano senator. What is the result of all of this effort?
Oh, it's inevitable. It's inevitable. Former Lieutenant Governor Hobby, wrote an article not too long ago. He said there was a lot of dangers facing Texas, and one of the dangers was a dropout rate, and the other was the lack of educational standards for our kids. He mentioned a couple others, but one that he mentioned was the increasing minority population of Texas.
As a danger.
And I read it, and I said, man, this guy has the gall to say that. But once you read it, what he meant was that because we're not educating the browns and blacks, we're going to have an underclass So unless we get serious about educating these folks, that we're not going to be able to manage our economy or participate in the potential for a global economy. So we're not talking about just trade with Mexico, we're talking about trade with all of Latin America. You have a lot of Mexicans, but they can't speak English or Spanish, and they can't read the computer. We have nothing. It doesn't do any good to have masses. And so he spoke out from that vantage point. But, you know, I think that, unlike Hobby, I think it's a positive attraction for Texas, and it makes Texas the trendsetter, not California. Texas has, even look at Texas now, we have a heck of a lot more Mexicano elected and appointed officials than California or any other state in the Southwest, New York or Florida. Of course, you start talking differences about philosophy, Republican, Democrat, but we just talk about appointed elected official. We have a lot more. And so it's inevitable that because of our population growth, our younger population, or rather, yeah, our younger median age, to be more specific, our higher average family size, our higher fertility rate, our growing immigration patterns, regardless of what they do, they can't build a 2,300 mile wall, a China wall, the equivalent China wall, even though they'd like to, and if they do, it's still going to be penetrated. You take all these factors, Texas is literally going to explode with Latinos. So they then have to be integrated into the political process and not just into the workforce. And I guess that's the key. Are we going to be able to integrate these folks into the political process? We've always thought in earlier eras that because we had more numbers, we would have more opportunities, and that's not necessarily true. As we're seeing, 1996, we have more numbers, and we may have more elected officials, but we don't have more opportunities. So what's wrong in the equation? Something's missing. 2 and 2 don't add up to 4. But I do think that taking the fact that a Victor Morales with no money, no resources, and unknown, unknown quantity, good guy, bad guy, who knows, can capture a Democratic nomination in an off year, means that it's only a short time before Mexicano can run and be governor. I guess Henry Cisneros could be governor. I guess he could be senator if he really set his mind to it. But it can't be done by Mexicano votes alone. It will require a coalition. I think that Victor Morales, in that regard, was somewhat of an aberration, because in November we'll see that his numbers may be truly representative of what Texas thinks of Mexicano. There'll be a lot of, there won't be so much straight ticket voter Republican as there will be crossover voting in that race.
You were spending time now talking to youth, and you have pointed out some of the commissions, things that we did wrong, and you point out some omissions, things we're not doing, like this: get a job, get an education, get a house, and seek an important position. What sage advice of a political nature can you give to us in terms of what can a young person do, male or female, if they want to get into the political arena now and get to be that governor, get to be that senator, ride that tide to be the reality as opposed to the inevitable? Last question.
Well, I saw a movie the other day, City Hall. It was a pretty lousy movie. Talked about a guy who, forget the actor's name, that well-known actor, but a guy who was fresh out of college and joined the mayor's office in New York, and the mayor had White House written all over him, but he became subjected to scandal and gave in to all the temptations of graft and corruption. And so the idealistic young man basically turned him in, lost all hope, but eventually returned and used that experience to better himself and ran for political office. The movie ends like that, where he's running for political office. So I think that first we have to get a good, broad, liberal arts education. I really think that the broader the education, the better. And I think that during your college career, or during a college career, every youngster should work in some internship position in the summer. And I think our Mexican community, I hire people out of high school right now. Not during the summer, I have one high school girl and one college student working for me right now, just as a clerk. I let them come in, handle files, I let them return calls, I let them speak to adjusters. The adjusters don't like it, they don't like talking to these little girls. But these little girls are smart, and they're gaining their self-confidence. But that's number one. Continue. Be learning while you're going to school, but learn about a job while you're in college. Yes. Yes, sir. Not much. Oh, you didn't? Okay. 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 No problem. Okay. That's all right. Okay. You at your house? Okay, I'm with Jose Angel Gutierrez right now. I'll tell him that a member of the clergy sends his regards. Okay, you're going to be in then Sunday? Okay. Okay. You have my house number, right? Okay. All right. Father Bill from a buddy's picture behind those roses over there, he was a priest over at Holy Family, then was chased out of town by the bishop because he was too much of an activist. Now he's up in Austin, Our Lady of Guadalupe. He's done a lot of work with Ernie Cortez and Harrington's up in there, trying to spread the ministry to where it becomes a catalyst for social change. They don't like priests like that. You know, they want them just to go by the gospel.
Well, to tend to the flock, yeah. Literally, to keep us in line and keep us accounted for.
Yeah, so I guess come back, I think that I feel stimulates a lot of interest in young people, being inspired by the workplace, and I think too, learning as much as I can about the business community, about the banking industry, things that probably you and I, folks of our ilk, didn't care much about because we saw them as the oppressors, as the enemy. But you know, until we can infiltrate and dominate the forces on the other side, we're always going to be subject to their whim and fancy. We cannot fund a political campaign if we can't go get a loan from the bank. We cannot start our little business on the neighborhood if we cannot get a small business loan. And if they don't think that we have the capital, if our families aren't independently wealthy, which means that most of our kids aren't going to qualify for that first-time loan, if we don't have all those ingredients of capital formation, venture capital, whatever, we're going to have a hard time making it. So I think it has to be a combination of business political. I really do think that to be successful political figures, we need to take a little bit of our libertarian training and master a little bit of the business technology, become computer literate, and then hit the ground running as volunteers. And when you become a volunteer, you're going to find the next time, you're going to find if you have done a good job in educating yourself, because nobody's going to educate you. Everybody has to educate themselves now. And I used to think that we had to be educated. You have to educate yourself. And if you're well educated, you're going to find that when you're the volunteer, you're going to find that you can do the job better than that office holder. I mean, that's always the case. We can do the job, but that's what this interview has been about. We feel that we have a better vision than those who are in office. And I suspect if we were office holders, we'd probably be subject to the same pressures and the same failings that these guys and women experience. Because that's the nature of the political beast in America. I think I read an article the other day that one thing that led Vince Foster, if that's his name, to suicide is that he was completely disenchanted with Washington and with power politics in D.C., that he thought he could go to Washington, D.C. and make a difference. And instead, he was going to have to worry about Whitewater, something that happened 10, 12, 14 years ago. And for whatever the reasons, yes, presumably, if he did commit suicide, he couldn't take it a day longer. And that leads to a lot of cynicism, the Watergate mentality, the Vietnam nightmare. So our kids need to rise to a different level and learn from history and avoid those mistakes. But as Mexicanos, don't use all those credentials just to go join the Republican Party and do the same things the others are doing. If you join the Republican Party, join the Republican Party to reform it so that we eliminate the likes of the Newt Gingrich and the Pat Buchanan tirade that he can in New Hampshire say, our job is to keep Jose out. You get a thunderous applause, says something different in California. So I never heard any Mexicano or Latino Republican or Latino congressman come out and lash out at Buchanan. Maybe I missed the article. But we don't have a lot of courageous office holders. So if they get into political office, our young people need to develop that backbone to have that courage to speak out against injustice, because injustice occurs in all walks of our life as we know today.
I forgot to ask you, when you stopped being active in MED?
Norberto Salinas, if I recall, followed me as chairman, county commissioner from Hidalgo. And as I recall, he didn't need any advice from me. And I attended some meetings, but it was probably in the early 90s. That's not too long ago. But about that time, my oldest daughter is a 10th grader. About that time, I think she hit middle school, and I decided it was time to spend more time watching them grow and play. So they're all good student athletes, and I enjoy that. So I haven't missed any of it. I haven't missed MAD. And when I saw it, learned of the schism, I was, you know, even more grateful. I just thought politics as usual. The schism made news this time. It's happened before, as we know. It's always been Valley against,
the world.
The world, and Corpus Christi trying to find a niche in there somewhere. It's just always been a joke.
There was that big fight between Moya out of Austin and
right.
I forgot who the person was. So.
Well, I guess it wasn't Moya and Campos, was it?
I don't remember. I just know Moya was in fist fights.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't a total rupture. It was just
Juan Maldonado. Yeah. And you know, I don't know why we have to come to that level. We can be disagreeable in a civil way. What is it all about anyway? Being MAD chairman. You're MAD chairman, then you look around and say, well, where's my station area? Where's my staff? Well, you can have this little cubbyhole at the Democratic Party headquarters and we'll take messages for you. And the hell with you, I set up my own office, my own staff, and I'd get calls all the time, Reuben, you shouldn't be doing this. Well, hey, you know, you can't control MAD. We're an arm of the Democratic Party. But if the Democratic Party is doing something wrong, you know, it's my job to spell it out. I remember I had a press conference one, and lambasted taco politics. And because I said, you know, that's typical, you know, go down the valley, well, Pechanga, slap you in the back, give you a taco, vote for me, and they take off on the plane to the next taco politic route. So we call them pachangas, but they're taco politics. And behind closed doors, that's how they think of us. And let's not fool ourselves.
We've covered a lot of ground. If you were writing this this manuscript on Mexicano politics in Texas, any question that you would ask that I haven't been able to think of?
I guess I would wonder whether or not it's possible in our lifetime to see Mexicano entrepreneurs come together and purchase a newspaper. We've done the magazine angle, but the magazine, as we've seen, is very glossy and it's pretty much Chamber of Commerce stuff, and it highlights, and I'm sure I have one here somewhere, Hispanic business, highlights primarily, you know, the success stories. If we owned a newspaper, would we do it differently? Would we profile our youngsters, or would we take the journalistic view and, you know, sell newspapers? It's all about business. I'm a big believer that newspapers, I don't care if it's the Esquire or the Corpus Christi Caller, but particularly the Corpus Christi Caller, sex, sensationalism, and scandal, the three S's, you know. Always front page. There was an article the other day, I guess you could add on to that, murder and mayhem, you know. If a kid gets shot, front page. If Luvia Gomez, who was promoted assistant police chief, some gringa came out 12, 15 years ago saying that he seduced her in a motel room, and because of that, he shouldn't be assistant police chief, and that they had promised her that he would never be promoted again. And the newspaper put it on the front page. Front page, 14, 15 years ago. She never filed suit against him. She never lodged an EEOC complaint. She continued working. I mean, you know, maybe it does have some relevance, but would they have done it if, well, and the person who promoted Lou was a Mexicano police chief, Pete Alvarez. The irony is that Lou Villagomez, before being promoted this time, was promoted once before, 6 years ago, to commander by an Anglo police chief, Henry Garrett. Where were the outcries then? See? But you're led to believe that, but for the fact that a Mexicano promoted him, and now we got a Mexicano chief and a Mexicano chief, assistant chief, the two top people are Mexicanos, bring out the sex, man, knock them down. Well, he, credit to the chief, he said, I'm not going to back down. That's my man. You know, what happened 15 years ago doesn't have a bearing on my decision because I know what type of man he is. So I really think that somebody out there eventually is going to have to put some resources together and impact the media, or maybe, and I'm sure, I know we own some TV stations, I guess, you know, Spanish TV stations, but they're not doing a damn thing. Caoro, here locally, my brother has an interest in that, but, you know, they're not exactly pioneers in investigative reporting. Why don't they run stories on what Richard Barcher has done over there? Why the appointment of the Anglos when we finally have four county commissioners who are Mexicano? I thought that's what all the battle was about, you know. I thought that's why Rosanita was organized, so that we could control our destiny. No, we do the same thing the Anglo does. So, I don't know what today's students are going to do tomorrow. That's for them to decide. You know, they'll have to decide whether or not they have a conscience. If they're not sure if they have a conscience, they need to think of how their grandmother and grandfather live. Probably their parents these days are doing a little bit better if they're in college. But I'd say think back about their grandparents and how they lived in this state and the indignity that was heaped upon them. And then they need to think about the millions of Mexicanos who still live that way and see if they want to make a difference for them. So we have a tendency to fall into a middle class syndrome. And I guess that's maybe the last thing that we need to remind our kids. Don't fall into middle-class syndrome. I'm in it a little bit, but maybe to assuage my guilt for not being an activist anymore, I go into the schools. I even bought a billboard here recently. Something says, help our, and it hadn't gone up yet, it says, help our youth, support our schools, get involved. You know, hell, just go to the PTA meeting. You know, make a difference. Don't defend your son if he does something wrong, but support your son if he does something right and show him where he was wrong. So, I think that makes a big difference in our kids' lives, and it'll eventually get them out of gangs and get them to the route to, whether they're going to the workforce or going to college or going to the Army, they'll be a success.
Well, thank you very much for being so gracious with your time. You gave me a hell of a lot more time than either one of us expected.
Well, it's all right. It's fun. It's always fun to see you, talk to you.